Our argument is Shaw versus Intercontinental Hotels, Mr. Victor.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Herbert Victor. I represent the plaintiff in this appeal. Good morning, counsel, with the court's permission. Plaintiff takes an appeal from an order of the district court dated November 25th, dismissing plaintiff's motion for reconsideration for failing to comply with Local Rule 78.2. By way of background, the plaintiff filed its original complaint in the Circuit Court of Cook County on September 19th, 2001. The defendant filed a notice of removal on August 6, 2001.
So what your complaint in, and then you filed a new complaint, so your complaint in the state court, what was the basis of that complaint? What were you looking for?
We're looking for, Your Honor.
Is it the same as the complaint?
It was the same, yes. The factual situation is the same.
So what's this business about Illinois public policy? What's that about? I've never seen a complaint like this.
Well, the complaint itself, Your Honor, is not an issue at this point in time. It's whether or not the plaintiff had an opportunity to respond to the defendant's 12B6 motion.
I'm trying to figure out what you were thinking in your complaint. How would you expect to get anywhere in the Illinois Circuit Court by charging a violation of public policy? What's that about?
Public policy, not to discriminate.
Well, is there a statute? Is there common law? Is this a breach of contract suit or what?
It is a retaliatory matter, Your Honor.
What do you mean retaliatory matter? What's the legal pigeonhole that this fits into? That's obviously what bothered the judge. He doesn't have the legal category.
Well,
no one files a complaint saying something violates public policy. I don't get it.
If that was what the district court judge was leaning towards, we would still have a right, Your Honor, or the ability.
Well, okay. So now explain to me what would you do? What legal category does your claim fall in?
My claim falls under, Your Honor, the category whether the plaintiff was forced to expend an enormous amount of money to renovate.
So what legal principle is violated by this?
Fraud.
Fraud? Is this a fraud suit?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you mention fraud in your complaint?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not prepared to argue.
How are you going to get anywhere in a lawsuit if you can't fit the defendant's conduct into a legal category?
But then I have the plaintiff would then have the obligation, Your Honor, or the ability.
That's what
Your
I'm
Honor,
asking you.
To amend.
Could you explain to me, please, if you were permitted to amend this 1,000 times, what would you charge?
We would charge that the conduct of the defendant was deliberately designed to cause the plaintiff to expend a huge amount of money to renovate when the defendant would not then renew the lease to the plaintiff.
So you're saying they fraudulently induced you to spend money on improvements that
benefit them
own.
Only.
Is that what you're
that
arguing?
Benefit them only. You understand, with no intent of renewing the lease. The defendant that filed a motion, Your Honor, to a 12B6 motion to strike the complaint on October 17th, on September 25th. And the court, on September 17th, 2001. And prior to the presentation of the motion on September 25th, 2001, the court granted their motion and ordered the plaintiff to file a motion for reconsideration. By October 17th, 2001, the plaintiff filed a motion for reconsideration and filed it by virtue of a notice of filing and not a notice of motion. because it was ordered by the court to be filed on a specific date. On November 26th, the defendant filed another motion to strike the motion for reconsideration, or in the alternative, for leave to respond to reply to the motion. Again, prior to the presentation of the motion on November 28th, 2001, the court granted their motion to strike plaintiff's motion for reconsideration because the plaintiff did not comply with Local Rule 78.2.
Now, opposing counsels have warned you about that, right?
Letters have went back and forth. Telephone calls went back and forth, Your Honor.
Yeah.
From October 26th to November 12th. He said, the defendant did not ask me why I filed pursuant to a notice of filing as opposed to a notice of motion. He said, when do we have a chance to respond? I said, I don't know when we have a chance to respond. The traditional method of operation in the district court is you file a potentially dispository motion. There is a briefing schedule. Plaintiff has his opportunity to answer. Defendant has an opportunity to respond. The court will rule. The court did not follow that motion, that procedure here. The court adopted its own procedure that the players were obligated to follow. Now, and in the give and take between the two offices between October 26th and November 12th, I indicated I don't know. I really don't know whether you do or whether the court's going to contemplate an opportunity for the defendant to respond or not. All I know is we're ordered to file a motion for reconsideration. We filed a motion for reconsideration.
Was there any discussion of 78.2 in this dialogue you had with opposing counsel?
No. Nor was there any discussion that the opposing counsel did not get adequate notice. The motion was filed. I think that the record reflects that the motion was typed as a notice of motion and handwritten to be filed as a notice of filing. In the court's dismissal for failure to follow Local Rule 78.2, the court did what we believe two things. In our brief, we indicate clearly that the well-established rule of law is that when a potentially dispository motion is filed, the responding party has an opportunity to reply. That creates a level playing field. And it was my understanding and my belief that when the court entered its order of September 25th, it gave the plaintiff an opportunity to reply by filing the motion for summary judgment. But in filing a motion for summary judgment, Your Honor, summary judgment, I'm sure the court is well aware, only shows manifest error or total disregard for the law or for the facts. It doesn't afford an opportunity to replead and cure, if there is any necessity to cure, a defect in the pleadings. Plaintiff was denied and deprived of that. Also, plaintiff is the respondent. Plaintiff has always been the respondent. The moving party in the 12B6 motion is the defendant. The court's order of September 25th does not change the position of the plaintiff from respondent to moving party. The court ordered the plaintiff to file a motion for summary judgment by a specific date. Now, the local rule 78.2 clearly deals with the moving party and deals with the moving party's obligation to give notice and the moving party's obligation to indicate to the non-moving party the existence of a potentially dispository motion. Plaintiff was never a moving party. The court order of September 25th did not render the plaintiff from a moving party, from a non-moving party to a moving party, and Rule 78.2 had no application to the plaintiff. I see the light is on, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Victor. Mr. Koala?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Kowal. I represent the Intercontinental Hotel Chicago. This is a case where the plaintiff filed a complaint which was defective on its face. It was defective in state court when it was first filed. It was defective in federal court. The first time Judge Castillo saw it in early August, he, sua sponte, struck it and gave
it. Well, I don't understand his handling of it. I don't get it at all. He didn't explain what the problem with the complaint was, so he didn't give the plaintiff any clue as to what he should do to patch it up.
Well, I think, Your Honor, first of all, the complaint was clearly defective on its face. It does not state a legal theory. And as your discussion...
Well, it's very unclear what a complaint is supposed to contain under the federal rules. Now, clearly, you know, it's just supposed to give you notice. So maybe the judge thought, well, it's just so vague, it's referenced to Illinois public policy, it just didn't give notice. So then you could tell the plaintiff, your complaint doesn't even rise to the level of notice pleading. You have to file something better, or else I'm going to dismiss. But to dismiss it without giving a reason, and then invite a motion to reconsider. How do you reconsider something when you don't know what the reason?
Your Honor is one step ahead of...
Doesn't make any sense.
Your Honor is one step ahead of me and the judge. When Judge Castillo struck it the first time on August 10th, that was because, in Judge Castillo's opinion, it did not contain what a federal court pleading should contain, and the plaintiff was given leave to amend. Then, approximately a month later, on September 17th, defendant filed a 12B6 motion again to strike the same complaint. Plaintiff had amended it once, but the only thing they chose to amend was the jurisdictional and the venue statement. Defendant suggested to this court that this complaint was always defective on its face. I've never seen a complaint that refers to just public policy. There's no statute set forth. There's no case law set forth.
But did Judge Castillo ever say that that was what was wrong with the complaint?
His order of August 10th says that the complaint was not a proper federal court complaint, is what his order
and
said.
And why? Did he say why it's not a proper
He did
complaint?
Not say why, Your Honor.
So why didn't he say what was wrong with the complaint and say to the plaintiff, you should patch it up or you're out?
I can't explain that for the judge, but I will suggest, Your Honor, that I filed a motion on September 17th, a month later. And I specifically pointed out what was wrong with this complaint and pointed out that invalid against public policy of Illinois did not state a cause of action, that this did not have any of the earmarks of a properly pled complaint. There's no reference in here to fraud. There are no prima facie elements of fraud referenced in here. I didn't even realize until counsel was up here that fraud was part of this complaint. But having said that, I filed the motion, and counsel had 8 days from the time I filed it to do something. Either appear and argue it, ask to brief it in a motion, file a written response, or ask to amend. And I appeared before Judge Castillo and related the fact that I'd gotten a phone call the evening before from counsel suggesting that he wanted the opportunity to brief it. No one was there to argue the complaint. The judge looked at it and said, this is still the defective complaint that I saw before, and he dismissed it. But he gave the plaintiff an opportunity to try to salvage it by allowing the plaintiff to file a motion to reconsider. And I think it was clear from Judge Castillo's order that he
would. But how would a motion to reconsider do anything? I don't get that. If the problem with the complaint is that it's defectively pleaded, then what will a motion to reconsider do? It's still that doesn't cure anything.
The judge was trying to find out and delve into what plaintiff's, at least I believe, the judge was trying to find out what plaintiff's legal theory was.
So why don't we issue an order saying your complaint doesn't contain a legal theory, so either file a new complaint or go away?
Well, I think that's some in substance what the judge said, Your Honor, at the hearing, but counsel for the plaintiff wasn't there to hear that. So counsel for the plaintiff was given the opportunity to become the moving party to file a motion to reconsider. And the motion to reconsider was not circumscribed by Judge Castillo. If the plaintiff wanted to come in and file an amended complaint in the motion to reconsider as new evidence for the court to consider, they could have. if they wanted to attach...
But there are standards on what is proper in a motion to reconsider. I do not understand why he would invite a motion to reconsider.
I think, Your Honor, it would have been completely appropriate for Judge Castillo to strike the complaint and leave it at that, but I think he wanted to give the plaintiff the opportunity to try to explain...
Well, if he'd never explained to the plaintiff what was wrong with the complaint, it's a little hard for the plaintiff to respond.
I think what was wrong with the complaint was straightforward and that the plaintiff had opportunity to come into court. It seems to me that we're putting the burden on Judge Castillo to make this complaint proper, and I think the burden is on
the
plaintiff.
Well, he took the burden, because didn't he dismiss the first complaint before you had filed a 12b-6?
Yes, he did, Your Honor, and that was an
opportunity. So he's the one who's taking the lead, but he's never giving, he's never telling the plaintiff what a complaint in federal court requires.
I don't think that's the judge's obligation, Your Honor. I think that's counsel's obligation. And Judge Castillo gave the plaintiff the opportunity to file. They could have filed a proposed amended complaint with the motion to reconsider. They could have filed a motion to amend the complaint in addition to the motion to reconsider. There was nothing that Judge Castillo did in his order of September 25th that prevented the plaintiff from making this complaint better and presenting a better complaint to Judge Castillo, as I said, either as part of the motion to reconsider or as a separate motion. But they didn't do that, and they've never done that in this case. And to ask Your Honors to look at this complaint and say, do you think we could delve something out of this that states a cause of action, I don't think you can make that determination, because there isn't enough in this complaint that indicates that. In order for you to find that Judge Castillo abused his discretion, I think you have to find that there is a viable cause of action here, given all the standards that apply under 12b-6. The other thing that I want to point out...
What if you had a complaint which just said that the plaintiff had been a victim of employment discrimination on grounds of race? Would that suffice?
I don't think it would, Your Honor. I think there's an element of pleading prima facie elements of a legal theory, not just putting a tagline on a complaint saying employment discrimination or...
What elements would you have to plead in an employment discrimination case?
Well, Your Honor, it's a good question, and I wish I knew it offhand, Your Honor, but I know that there are elements of you need an employment relationship, you need some kind of a statement.
But it's not clear that any of those things have to be pleaded, because if you look at the forms appendix to the federal rules, they approve extremely summary pleading. So I mean, look at the complaint on a promissory note. Defendant on or about June 1st, 1935, executed and delivered plaintiff a promissory note. Promise to pay X amount. Defendant owes the plaintiff the amount of said note and interest. Wherefore, plaintiff demands judgment. That's the entire complaint.
Your Honor, I think more applicable to this case.
Complaint for goods sold and delivered. Defendant owes plaintiff blank dollars for goods sold and delivered. Period. That's the end of the complaint.
Well, look at the common law elements of fraud, Your Honor, that there was a representation made, that the representation was material, that the representation was relied on. That is the way a complaint is typically
constructed. Yeah, because that's 9B. There are some facts that have to be pleaded specially, and I was as surprised as you were to have Mr. Victor pull fraud out of his hat, but I thought what his complaint was trying to allege was a violation of some Illinois either common law principle or statutory principle forbidding discrimination in commercial relations, though in this case not a contract.
And I would be speculating to say, Your Honor, one other point I wanted to make in responding to another issue was that the letter that went to Mr. Victor of October 31st, 2001, in the last line, this is Exhibit B, to the plaintiff's or appellant's brief, says, as your notice was never properly noticed up, Judge Castillo may decide simply to strike it. That, I believe, was reference to Local Rule 78.1 and Local Rule 78.1.2, excuse me, applies to all motions filed before the court. The plaintiff was the one who filed the motion to reconsider. It was the movement, and my office specifically informed Mr. Victor twice about this and even told him that if you don't notice it up for hearing, and he waited over a month, he did nothing, then the judge may choose to strike it, which the judge did.
But his response is, of course, the judge set the date in that minute order of October 17th to file a motion for reconsideration, which he did as the court ordered. He filed the motion. I understand it wasn't noticed up, but, I mean, that's his position.
That is his position, Your Honor, and I believe...
And then the court ruled on it before your motion that you had noticed up to strike his motion had even occurred. Do I have the sequence right?
No, I filed my motion to strike first, and then the court granted my motion to strike, and I brought my motion to strike and alternatively to file a response, since Mr. Vicker did not file a response and 30 days had lapsed. And I believe that it was not the obligation of the court to tell plaintiff's counsel that the rule applied. On its face, it said it applies to all motions, and we reminded him anyway.
But I thought several days before the motion call that you had noticed up to consider your motion, the court ruled on it.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So he didn't even have an opportunity to respond to your motion, which was properly noticed up, your motion to strike. So in other words, he didn't get an opportunity to explain that, you know, his interpretation, at least, of this minute order, that he didn't have to notice up the motion to reconsider because he was working under the court's order to just file this motion to reconsider.
I think your understanding of the chronology is correct, but I think the rule is clear that you have to notice it up for hearing, and we asked him twice to do that over a month, and he didn't. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Koala. Mr. Victor, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
The original complaint, Your Honor, that was removed from the state court to the federal court, when the judge asked for it to be amended, I amended it to reflect federal court procedures, with federal court jurisdiction, and the proper caption to the federal court. That was my understanding what the court meant by the first requirement for amendment.
So you thought it just had to do with the way the complaint appeared, not the substance of the complaint?
Right, with the cosmetic way that it
the format, the heading, and that.
Instead of saying the Circuit Court of Cook County, which the complaint said, you know, I mean, in the standard form that the federal court would accept. The issue, Your Honor, as to 72.8 recites Rule 5.3, and Rule 5.3 indicates that the timing for the notice of motion. The very first words of 5.3 is, except in case of emergency or by order of court, I'm not too sure it says order of court, or by order, you understand, the following shall apply, so forth and so on. We have an order of court. First of all, I believe that the plaintiff is not bound by 72.8 because the plaintiff is not the moving party. The plaintiff is responding to court order. The plaintiff has always been the non-moving party. Secondly, 72.8, which refers to 5.3, indicates that except in cases of emergency or by court or by order of court, the following shall apply. We have an order of court. Now, we're not complaining about the court's changing the time-honored procedure of a motion being filed and a briefing schedule and a ruling date or a ruling by mail. The court has the right to do that. We're complaining about the confusion that the court's method created, unfair, and to the jeopardy of the plaintiff. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, both counsel. Last case for argument is